The Skippy and Fanny Show is listener supported, which means basically you guys listen and we feel really good about ourselves. But if you'd also like to help us a little bit, you can go to audibletrial.com/skippyandfanty, sign up for a 1 month free trial membership, get a free book, which is pretty cool, and the bonus is that it helps us a little bit. So go ahead and check that out at audibletrial.com/skippyandfanty and enjoy the episode.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the Krell forgot one thing, yes. Monsters, John. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T-minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show, a Shoot the Wiz segment. I'm Sean, and my special guests today are Keffy.
Hello.
And David.
Hello.
Although I guess technically, David, you're not special anymore because you're just now part of staff.
I'm just mundane.
Yeah, and Keffy's secret staff. So,
yes.
You're a little bit cooler than David by default. Just because you're secret.
Oh, okay.
I tease. Today we are talking about, technically we're talking about Riddick, but we decided to do all three films of the Riddick trilogy, excepting the animated film and any of the video game stuff. So we're just going to be talking about Pitch Black, Chronicles of Riddick, and the new movie, Riddick. So we're going to do them in that order. So we'll start off by talking about Pitch Black, which for most of us has probably been, we've seen that one already, at least a couple times, I'm assuming. Why don't we start by talking sort of general reactions to the film as we've seen it, you know, in retrospect, sort of rewatching the film. So we'll start with you, Keffy, some sort of general reactions about Pitch Black.
Well, Pitch Black, I saw it the first time when it first came out in the theater. So that was 2000, and I think I was 16. And then I rewatched it recently for this podcast. And I was actually surprised that it held up really well. In fact, I don't think that the quote-unquote suck fairy visited it at all. And it was about as good as I remembered it when I was 16, which is really high praise because most of the movies I liked when I was a teenager are absolutely terrible in every way. There's a lot of things that I liked about Pitch Black. The biggest one for me, which I'm mentioning because it'll be important later, is that I really liked how the characters are... Well, there are actually women in this movie, more than one. And they have very different personalities. There's not just the woman archetype. And in fact, I think for most of the movie, Carolyn, the pilot, is actually the protagonist pretty much until the very end of the movie. I also just generally enjoy Riddick headbutting predators, so that was also fun. I don't know. I think I should have more intelligent things to say about this movie, but it's been a favorite for a long time.
Fair enough, fair enough. David, general reactions from you?
Yeah, you know, I'd pretty much second all of that. I think it holds up as a really, essentially a good tight B movie with pretty impressive production values, but still it wasn't a kind of triple A budget feature. And I remember when I first saw it, finding that opening crash was the most intense spaceship crash I had ever seen, and I think it still holds up really well. And yeah, the ditto with all the characters. I mean, I think the film has something that the others don't, in that it's smart in that Riddick is essentially, yes, a supporting character. And even there, he has a bit of an arc, which he doesn't in the other two. And it is, yes, Fry's film for most of it. And it is her arc of redemption that we're following for much of the film. And the other thing that really struck me at the time, which, and we still haven't seen much like that, is how it has... As far as the various spiritual or lack of spiritual faiths being presented in the film, that the kind of default religious faith in there is Islam. I mean, when have we ever seen that in a film before or since?
Never. At least not an American film.
Yeah, I mean, you could argue that the imam is actually the most sympathetic character in the entire movie, and he's a black Muslim man, which is really interesting, and I don't think I've ever seen it in an American movie.
Yeah, and he's a character that reappears in the next film, and equally as interesting, I think, despite the fact that he's not as present, and he dies in the second film, in case you didn't know. So, yeah, I mean, he's still, for me, one of my favorite secondary characters is the imam. Although I kind of wish he had a name.
But he is the moral center of the film, which is really interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, technically, he's played as Muslim. And what's really interesting is I've always just thought of him as just a very, like, the sort of spiritual center for the film, which you could have insert any sort of spiritual belief into that, because it's not overtly, and except that he uses cues that are Muslim cues, but there's very little like scripture type sort of cues where it's sort of narrowing the focus. So it's like, yeah, we're only dealing with Islam, and this is the kind of Islam we're dealing with. It's he says Allah and they pray and in Arabic and these kinds of things, but there's not a lot of that sort of I want to say like religious preaching, despite the fact that he does kind of preach, but in a different, I don't know. Does that make sense? What I'm trying to get at? You could kind of insert any sort of spiritual belief into his character, with the exception that obviously he is a Muslim character.
I'm not sure because I don't know enough about Islam to say.
Yeah, I'd be leery of making it generic that way myself, and that's also speaking from my own position of ignorance, right?
He also does have a name.
Does he have a full name? Because he's always just said he's just the imam.
So I don't know if this is stated in the movie or if it's just like credits or whatever, but it's Abu al-Walid.
Okay, interesting. This is
on IMDb, that's what's coming up as.
That's interesting, yeah, because he's only ever talked about it. I don't think they've ever said his full name, and if they have, it's so in passing. So that's interesting.
Well, yeah, I mean, and it's also interesting that this happens while they're on a Hajj, which is, yeah. I mean, the major pilgrimage. So, it's just really interesting. And I also think it's really important that they have him as a spiritual center for the film, because literally every other character is at best morally gray in this movie.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Yeah.
And I think what I find really quite striking about the use of him there is that the film doesn't make any kind of big production over what his faith happens to be, right? It's just that's what it is. A little bit like the way in Night of the Living Dead, with its lead, it wasn't making a big point about his race. It just had him there, and in that way was a lot more radical than a lot of the movies from around the same time that were making a big song and dance over who they had in the lead.
Yeah, and I guess what I'm identifying with why I find his character so much more interesting as a religious figure, maybe why I'm making him somewhat generic, is when you compare him with later religious figures that appear. So in the second film, Chronicles, you have these very dogmatic, almost religious figures in the form of the
necromongers.
Thank you. Right. They're very much dogmatically religious. They have their own humanoid god, all that kind of whatever. But then even in the last one with Luna, where he's this religious figure who just constantly talks about God. And it's very Christianized, and it's very sort of like it lacks the characterization that is so, I think, important for the imam figure played by Keith David, in which there is that religious element, but it's, I don't know, he's a character, I like him, and the fact that he's religious and by extension that he's Muslim is just, the way it's done is really well done, I think. So, and he's just a great character, and I wish he had not died in the second movie, because he should be around.
Plus, he's played by Keith David, and that's always awesome, too.
Yeah, Keith David's pretty kick-ass. But yeah, like one of the other things that since we're already talking about things we like about the film, you know, you've already mentioned the space crash, which I agree with you, David. It's a very fascinating moment. It's really high intensity. It's really well done on a relatively small production budget, at least by Hollywood standards. I think they did, the budget was like, what, like $30 million or something? Something fairly small. I can't remember what the budget is.
$23 million.
$23 million. So like even smaller than I thought, right? Just incredible amount of really well done just graphics, and they're really careful where they use the effects, the special effects. They only use them when they absolutely must. And they're just very, they find lots of clever sort of camera trickery to get around some of the other kinds of issues that you wouldn't be able to cover with sort of the computer, just because of the budget. But even on top of that, this, I find as a narrative, it's much more tight than I think even with something like Chronicles, which I love Chronicles, but like that, this narrative of Pitch Black, you know, they've crash landed on this planet by, you know, they've run into this comet trail, this rogue comet, and it's fucked up their whole travel and the crash. And everyone's worried about the big bad murder guy, but it's actually not him you're supposed to be worried about. But even the narrative, right, this idea they have to get off the planet, and the narrative of Riddick as being this, I don't know if saying morally ambiguous or maybe just psychopathic, as a psychopathic character, but even there's some development for him throughout the narrative. So it just feels very tight as a film, even though it begins as just a sort of slasher flick that takes place in space, and then quickly becomes sort of a sci-fi horror in which the actual horror isn't – well, I should rephrase that. The actual horror is probably the humans. They're actually the most terrifying part of this, is how quickly they devolve into their sort of – the most disturbing parts of humanity. But then at the top of that, right, the physical threat is this alien monstrosity, which cannot be reasoned with. It's absolutely animalistic. So, but yeah, I'm kind of rambling.
Well, I think the heart of Pitch Black is not, I mean, it's, I like the monsters in Pitch Black, but the heart of it is the way that the characters interact when the shit hits the fan.
Right. Yeah.
And even though if I look at them, like, I would say that many of the characters you could probably put into archetypes, they have enough other stuff going on that they don't view like cliches or like stereotypes to me. Like, I felt for them when they died. Even the ones I didn't really like that much, I still cared when they got eaten.
Yeah, they were interesting. You wanted to know more about them, and you were invested with them when the stuff started happening.
Yeah. But that's kind of what I mean. Like, it's very much about the human characters, and that's actually where the terror is, in how quickly characters that are one way, we think they're this one person, and suddenly they're not. They've turned into something else. Like Johns is a great example, right? We all think he's a police officer. He's, you know, up on the law. Like, even Fries, right, gives him this piece of knowledge, you know, in confidence, and we see how quickly he turns from being the good guy to actually being more villainous than the guy we're supposed to be afraid of, which is Riddick. And that the film does that, I think, the paces that evolution very carefully. So at the end, he really is sort of that. We don't actually want him to survive anymore. We actually like the psychopathic murderer more than we like that guy. At least that's how it worked for me.
Yeah, go ahead, Kefi.
Oh, I was just going to say, I actually didn't mind if he, like, I would have been okay with him living as long as he wasn't the only one left alive. Because the thing is, like, what he does, because he, you know, he decides that, you know, what they need to do is kill Jack so that they can get through all the monsters. And he is sort of an asshole. Okay, he is an asshole through most of the movie. But his reasons for being an asshole, I thought were pretty sympathetic. Like, yes, he's a morphine addict, and yes, he's self-centered, but he also has this, like, ongoing pain because he has part of a shiv stuck in his back from the last time he had a run-in with Riddick. So I thought he was sympathetic, but an asshole. I mean, I didn't think he was any less sympathetic than Riddick. It's just that Riddick has fallen on the other side of the line that is, do you kill children to stay alive?
Mm, yeah, because Riddick doesn't make that choice. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Riddick is, I guess, more the anti-hero and anti-hero and John's the what we think is going to be the hero, and yeah, and becomes the antagonist. But they're both, Yeah, I agree. We know why they're the way they are.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Yeah, it's. I love this film. It's good. It also scared me when I saw it in theaters, but it doesn't scare me as much anymore, but that's because I've seen it a couple times, so. But I mean, so we've already mentioned a lot of the characters, and we're getting close to the 15 minutes here, so we're going to have to scooch to the next film. But is there any criticism that you would have of the film?
So this is a criticism that doesn't actually make me enjoy the movie less, but the science is really bad. I was watching it with my friends and they were like, how do these monsters survive? If they're only eating once every 22 years. And I was like, that actually is something I have less of a problem with because I don't know, maybe there's stuff they're eating underground or maybe they're like giant, you know, carnivorous cicadas. My concern was more along the lines of, I don't think that solar system is possible based on any knowledge of physics that I have. So even when I saw it when I was 16, that kind of threw me out of the movie a little bit, but I was willing to go with it because the movie's great.
It's like, I'll let it slide.
Yeah, that didn't bother me very much either. And maybe because the setup is so bizarre that, you know, like just even trying to figure out whether that would work or not, I just gave up as a bad game and was able to run with it in a way that I couldn't in the with the cockamamie science that would follow in the later films. It just, you know, my disbelief was cheerfully suspended for its entire running time. Mm. And the monsters looked cool. So I guess my one reservation is in some ways one that's been exacerbated by what comes next, and that's the ultimately sacrificial nature of the primary female characters, right? So though most of the movie is Fry's tale and her move towards redemption, she ultimately has to die for Riddick to achieve his redemption at the end, and it's something that I might not have been as aware of with the film on its own, so much as the pattern that starts to show up in the other ones, and so what Twohy starts to feel the need to do to his female characters.
Yeah, I would agree there. Like, I understand why she dies, and I can see that redemption as being important. But I think one of the things that's really troubling about that is that he's not the one that is supposed to be redeemed. It's actually supposed to be her, and technically she's already redeemed herself by the fact that mm-hmm. she's basically put her whole life on the line to save everybody and dies in the process. But I understand that criticism. I think it is a flaw, but I also see the value in having that there because I think Twohy always had expected that Riddick would be our central figure and he would be the quote-unquote hero. But you can't have a hero who has no sense of morality and has zero interest whatsoever in helping anyone but himself. And so the second film is impossible without that redemption. It doesn't work.
Oh yeah, we need his redemption. It's just the means of it is we're entering into the fridging domain a bit.
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, absolutely.
Of the women in Riddick's fridge, I think this is
that has so many different meanings, Kefi. Just imagining like him keeping bodies in his fridge and literally.
I feel like, on top of this being, in my opinion, the best of the movies, I feel like this is the most justifiable death because the thing about Fry's death is that it also falls into this general trope where the only way anyone can ever be redeemed in any movie is by dying. Mm-hmm. So it sucks that it also turns into redeeming Riddick. Had the movies ended here, it wouldn't bother me because she redeems him, but she also redeems herself. So it makes me uncomfortable, but I agree with you. Like, if it wasn't for how things go in later movies, I wouldn't be as bothered by it.
Yeah. I think what we've already said is stuff that I probably would have said, although I got to be totally honest, of all of the films that are in this series, this one is the one that I think is the strongest for sure. Mm-hmm. And I suspect we all agree.
Oh, definitely, by a long way.
Yeah, I mean, it's a cleaner film. It never pretends it's not something, like it's not pretending to be something else, and it's not trying to be too much at once. It tells us pretty much, like right from the start, this is, even though there is that kind of shift when we realize that the actual, like, villain, as it were, is not Riddick, it's actually monster creatures and whatever. But we know from the start, this is going to be a horror survival movie in space with stuff, right? That's what we know, and that's what we get. And so everything else that surrounds that plot is about characterization, or in some cases, characters who we don't get a lot of at least die. And as you guys have said, for the most part, I don't always necessarily agree totally with you guys. We care about most of the deaths, except that I laughed very hard when the British like antiques dealer gets killed, because he was going to die anyway. He had to die. And it was just funny because he's kind of a douche. So I appreciate his death. But yeah, but I think it's just a cleaner film. So why don't we grade it? So you guys want to grade it? Move on to Chronicles?
Yeah, I think I've said everything.
All right, Keffi. So obviously it's an A to F scale, like just, you know, grading how we do in America. So what grade would you give it?
You know, I'm going to give it an A. I was thinking about an A minus, but I was like, screw it. I'll just give it a straight up A, because there are very few movies that I enjoy as much as this one.
Fair enough. David?
Yeah, you know, I went through the same dilemma, and I'm going to give it an A because it delivers exactly what it sets out to deliver and gives us a little bit more. So, yeah.
A. Yeah, and I completely agree with both of you. I think it deserves an A, even though probably if, like, the first time I saw it, I probably would have given it an A minus, but I think after seeing it over and over, it deserves its A. It really does. It just holds up. It's a film that holds up. It's good. So, cool. All right, so why don't we'll switch gears to Chronicles of Riddick. And I don't know if everybody saw the unrated director's cut, because that's the cut I watched. And I did mention that everyone probably should watch that one because it's the better cut.
Yeah, that is the one I've seen.
Okay. Now. Yeah, it's got a little bit more meat to it. And I mean, I don't remember what the theatrical version looked like because I haven't watched it, even though this version of the DVD I have actually has the theatrical version. So, but in any case, so why don't we start with general reactions to this film? So Keffi, general reactions to Chronicles of Riddick?
I really like this movie for almost completely different reasons than I like Pitch Black. It does really strange things. I remember, I did see it in the theater, though I don't remember what the difference is between the two cuts. But I remember really enjoying it and then also being very confused by it because at first I thought it was just that it has moved into a different subgenre of science fiction. But now I realize that, especially on a rewatch, that the other difference is that it's moved into a completely different universe from the first film because the way that Pitch Black is written, it almost seems like it could take place in a future version of our universe. Like, this is a future where people are able to travel around planets. And then Chronicles of Riddick sort of has magic in it. And it doesn't really seem to... they don't really seem to successfully retcon Riddick's history. So you get this strange mix of the past that was in Pitch Black and the past that's in Chronicles of Riddick, and they don't quite work. It's also really campy, and the dialogue is honestly atrocious. I love it anyway, but there are times when characters would say things in Chronicles of Riddick, and I just wanted to scream in pain. And then, this is not very critical of me, but I have a deep affection for Lord Vako's mullet. The worst mullet in all of film, and I love it because it is so terrible.
Fair enough. All right, David, general reactions.
Well, I remembered it. I'd seen it only in the theaters before the rewatch, and I remembered it as being a mess. And watching it again, yeah, it is a mess. And I sort of wonder how can this be written by the same guy? The first film was so tight. This one, it's almost picaresque, except it's formless, and this ridiculously extended second act in the prison that really doesn't contribute anything to the main, what was putatively the main conflict. I mean, the dialogue, yeah, it's either cringe or go with it. So you have, you know, all these testosterone cases growling their names at each other. Riddick, Tombs.
Yes, Tombs. Tombs.
And the characters are nowhere near as interesting as the first one. I think one of the mistakes is moving Riddick to the center of the film, at which point here and even more so next, the love that Twohy and Diesel apparently have for Riddick borders on the uxorious, and they're just. Yeah, all the stuff that I bought in the first one, I wasn't buying. I do love the aesthetic of the film. I like the gigantic statue spaceship things and the look of the Necromongers. All that is that's wonderful stuff. It's all silly and great. So that part's cool.
Okay, well, I'm going to disagree with both of you completely. This film is not quite as good as Pitch Black because it isn't quite as tight. However, it's still pretty much the most awesome science fiction film in a long time in terms of the kind of big, just dumb space opera. And it knows that that's what it is, which is why I love the dialogue, because the dialogue is not good dialogue. It's not. Like, if you listen to the film, it's not good dialogue. But within the context of the film, it's wonderful dialogue. It's deliciously campy. It's so much fun to hear them say things that, like, they must have paused and went, really? I'm going to have to say that? Yes, you are going to have to say that. It's completely balls crazy, but that's okay, because it's great what you're saying. I love the aesthetic of the film. I love that Riddick becomes central. I think that that's really great for his narrative that follows out from the previous ones. I like the structure of the film. With, you know, some caveats here or there, because there's certainly problems here or there. But I also love the sort of mysticism that was, I think, hinted at in the previous movie, but not hinted at very well. I mean, most of the mystical aspects of it are probably best embodied by the monsters that are in the caves. Here that they bring it out to the fore. And I just love, like, you know, Dame Judi Dench is an elemental. And she gets to say things like, she gets to say lines like, you know, oh, you know, like, oh, you know, elementals weak lied, and all these kinds of just lines that are terrible to give to Dame Judi Dench, but are so wonderful in this film because it is a campy film. It is a high octane, you know, high energy, you know, lots of special effects, just B movie awesomeness. It's fun and I love it. And the choreography is great. I just love it. I love this film. Sorry. Gonna disagree with everything you guys say. Bring it on, suckers.
Well, I will say that, I mean, that's why I enjoy it so much, is that it's extremely earnest, especially because we watched a few of the DVD special features, and there's one that is just Vin Diesel running around showing you the sets and being like, it's great, we did stuff here and here and here, and look at all this stuff we did. And so I like that it was so earnest, because I actually think that this may be one of the problems with Riddick, is that it dials things back too much for the third movie. Because
sure.
In Chronicles, I mean, they just go for it and don't seem to realize that possibly people won't be as into it as they are. But it doesn't matter, because they're just...
They're having fun!
Yeah, they're having fun. Like, there was clearly a lot of love of that movie. And I may be the only person, but I was super disappointed that it didn't turn into being the first movie of a trilogy, which I know they were initially thinking about. But unfortunately, there's only so much money you can lose on movies.
And they lost a lot.
Yeah, I think this one had like $100 million.
$105 million budget. They only made worldwide $115 million, which means they probably lost close to $100 million because of the advertising budget.
Yeah, there's fun to be had with it. I guess what frustrated me is that in terms of the big space opera stuff, there wasn't enough fun, partly because of that whole prison bit, which takes us away from the Necromongers for so long, and really puts the entire plot on pause while they're there. Because the all of the scheming and the palace intrigues and the conquering of the universe just goes to the side so we can have a prison escape film. And then the whole business with Riddick suddenly being able to unleash the combined rage of his lost people has to be the clumsiest Chekhov's gun I've ever seen. But I can see in some ways it almost feels like we're arguing at cross purposes, because the very things that are bugging me are the very things that you seem to love about it. So
pretty much, you know. Pretty much.
Yeah, I actually watched Pitch Black and Chronicles of Riddick back to back with my friends, who one of them had seen Chronicles and the other one hadn't seen either of them. And before I put Chronicles in, I was like, okay, so your enjoyment of this movie is dependent on me telling you that you need to pretend it's not a sequel, but kind of is, but also isn't a sequel to Pitch Black. Because I think if you come into it expecting it to be a straight up sequel of Pitch Black, it's just horrific.
I
do think that the story is a bit of a mess, because the pacing is really, really weird. Not even just the prison sequence, which I sort of enjoyed, but if you stop and start trying to think about character motivations and like what they do and don't care about, the Necromongers are the strangest all-powerful space force I have ever seen. They're almost all powerful, and yet they don't notice Riddick leaving or care. I mean, it's possible they just don't care, but I would have liked that to have been mentioned in the movie. Like, there's a lot of things that I can sort of fix if I rewrite it in my own head, but there's a lot of parts where I'm just like, would they really just not notice him leaving? Like,
wait, when do you mean when he leaves?
When the bounty hunters just magically show up and take him away?
No, they trace him. They trace them.
Yeah, but...
No, but they land on the planet magically.
Yeah, I mean...
No, they don't.
They
trace them.
No, they find him. They land there without getting blown out of the sky by the Necromongers.
Yeah, the Necromongers have just taken over this planet. And then the mercenaries just show up and steal this dude who's apparently super important, because the Lord Marshal is terrified that he's going to get killed by him. The only way that I can make it work, although it's not in the movie, is if I just assume that they're so overconfident because they're so used to smashing society so easily that they don't notice or care. But they are pretty nearsighted as a force.
Well, the Lord Marshal isn't. All of his commanders are, though. His commanders are all brutes. There's this really, I think, perfect scene for that when they've taken Prime, whatever the name of the planet is, Helion Prime, and they're sitting in the basically the war room, and there's the little weird thing with all the planets, and the guy's like, what we'll do is we'll just go beat up that first planet, and we'll take the next planet, and we'll take the next one, and he's like, well, brute force is nice, but why don't we try the more elegant way? And then he weaves this sort of like poetic imperialist idea. So there is, like, the Lord Marshal is perhaps has a little bit more finesse, but of course he's blinded by his own terror, as it were, when, you know, he just basically says, don't question it, Vako, go kill Riddick, and doesn't really give very useful instruction.
I did like the Lord Marshal because he's played by Comfior, who, you know, is another kind of, you know, from the Michael Ironside school of Canadian character actor villains, at least when he's not playing one of our prime ministers. So, and he's always great in chewing up the scenery in those sorts of roles. So I did enjoy him in there. But I do think there's a big problem that we see with Riddick, which is even more the case with the next one, is that in the first film, where A, he's a secondary character for much of it, but B, has an arc, right? Whereas here, where's his arc? You know, it's just like we are introduced, hey, here's Riddick, the most invincible badass. And we then spend the rest of the movie showing you, yep, he's the most invincible badass. And the end. There's no... I mean, where are we going with him?
There's an arc. There is an arc.
Okay.
Yeah, his arc is, and probably it's just not well-defined in the film, as I see it, is his reluctance to get involved precisely because it means becoming visible, and in the sense that if he becomes involved in the deal with the Necromongers, that means he actually has to take over this army of crazy psychopaths. And he doesn't want that kind. He just wants to disappear right from the beginning when he's on the ice planet. The reason he went there is he just wants to be gone. He wants to just not have to do with deal with anything. And he gets sucked back in by the people he's saved, who, in the case of Jack, she's tried to emulate him and then ended up in crematoria in this supermax prison. And in Keith David's case, right, he thinks there's something special about him and that he could help end the Necromonger's reign. And he doesn't want to get involved in either of those things, but of course he has to. He has no choice in the matter because, of course, he's now become involved. And so his arc is about reluctantly having to give in to that and having to make the choice that he's going to have to do something. And that becomes central, which is why the prison part is important, because when he saves Kira, or Jack, as she's known in the previous film, she ends up getting kidnapped, and he has to go rescue her, and that becomes the catalyst. But of course, this goes to the problem we had in the previous film, which I guess it's pretty clear now that Riddick keeps a lot of women in his fridge, because that's another female character that has to die to give him that kind of jolt in the right direction.
But you see, I don't see him getting that jolt. I don't see him stepping up to say, okay, I have to take responsibility for, you know, saving this planet or whatever. It's he's invisible. Yes, in fact, for much of the film, he's tried to be invisible in order to save Jack slash Kira, right, as he says. And then everything that happens, he's forced to take action because he's kidnapped or there's a price on his head or he's dragged into it. But it's always a question of being dragged and forced to perform. We never get to any kind of realization on his part where he goes, okay, you know what? I do have to help people or do this, you know, other than to try to – or Kira is the only character that he and perhaps a little bit the MM and his family that he is actually trying to do something for. Right. And so there's no saying, okay, I got to take over the responsibility of this, this army of zombies. It's like, oh crap, I'm sitting on this throne. I guess I'm in charge now.
Okay. Kefi.
Yeah. I was just going to say, I mean, if there is an arc, it's a very slim arc because his arc is reluctant. And then at the end, still reluctant.
Reluctant, but in power.
No. Yeah, but I mean, he's always reluctant, but in some amount of power, just not necessarily. I mean, because he always has the ability to, you know, kill his way out of any prison or survive on giant planets full of ice or whatever the hell it is he's doing. So I don't know. I mean, the more interesting arc is the one that isn't actually in the film. It's just alluded to. But I'm really interested in Jack's arc because she's. And it's one of those arcs where she's still kind of in the same place toward the end as she is at the beginning, but she's really mercenary in her ability to go from one thing to another, just trying to find a place where she's going to survive. And she's actually a lot like Riddick in that case, because she is sad that it looks like Riddick is dead, but her first move as soon as she thinks Riddick is dead on Crematoria, which is the funniest name ever for a planet, is to immediately enlist with the Necromongers. When she thought Riddick was gone as a 12-year-old, almost her first response was to join a mercenary crew and try to, you know, make her way that way. So she moves on really quickly all the time. But it's I would have been more interested to see more of what she's been doing for the past 5 years, like how she got into prison, because it's sort of alluded to, but we don't ever find out who she killed.
So. Mm, yeah. David?
Well, we never really find out the same thing with Riddick, too, or am I mistaken that in any of the films, we don't really know exactly why he is being hunted by everyone, other than the fact that, yeah, he's some kind of super criminal and has killed a lot of people, but, you know, I don't really have a problem with that. It remains kind of vague. I know we weren't really getting into these, but one thing I do think I want to at least mention is that the good thing that did come out of the second film was that it led to an absolutely superb video game, which was a gigantic critical and commercial success that has a Riddick who's somewhat more vulnerable, partly because you're playing him and you can screw up. And in a setting which was more concise, that worked all the way through as a story, and is the reason ultimately that we got a third film. Now, that might not be a good thing, but that's what kept the character alive, because that was the success, not this film.
Yeah, I think I didn't play the game, although it's interesting. So in the game, we don't find out what initially set him on this road to crime either.
No, it is set earlier, because it's in this game that you get the night sight. So it's set before Pitch Black, when he's in Butcher's Bay.
But they don't tell us why he's in Butcher's Bay, which I think is really interesting, because in the context, I mean, unless I'm missing something from the game, which, you know, I haven't played, in the context of all three of the films, we do see him killing people, and killing people quite cold-bloodedly in some cases, but we only see him killing people who are in some way threatening his well-being. And so I feel like it kind of falls into the, they're setting us up for sort of a, sometimes I almost, like, they're setting us up to almost forget that he's supposed to be a murderer, because he isn't actually doing anything worse in the movies in general than most of the characters that we're used to in science fiction action movies, because we generally expect that in a science fiction action movie, when your protagonist is threatened, they will blow the hell out of the villain or whatever. And so all of the morality that we get from Riddick that is worse, quote unquote, than a normal character is all stuff that happens well before we meet him and that we never find out about. And I think that's interesting. It kind of falls into that. I can't remember who wrote it, but there's that essay about Ender's Game where they talk about the innocent killer. It's not the same thing, but it's kind of the, we're set up to think that these characters are sympathetic because we don't have to put ourselves in the position of killing someone who doesn't quote unquote deserve it.
Mm. Fair point. All right, David, last comment, and then we got to grade it.
All right. Well, and just to follow up with that, what that winds up making a hash of Judi Dench's opening narration, where she says, you know, we have to fight evil with another kind of evil, and yet Riddick's just a badass. You know, we never see him kill anyone who doesn't have it coming. So how is he evil?
Sorta, kinda. He kills a lot of people who, like, even people that maybe are not good people and are assholes. But, like, he kills a lot of people that aren't necessarily deserving of death. Like, the idea that that is somehow, like, he just dispenses death. If people fuck with him, death. That's your option. Like, there's no, like, for him, that's the response to basically everything, which is not a position that even someone like Keith David's character, the Imam, would consider to be morally correct. He probably would consider that a form of evil.
Yeah, I just don't think that he's more evil than most of the characters that we see in action movies. Because
no, well, sure.
I mean, he does kill people that I personally would not believe need to die. But based on the rules of how action movies go down, he doesn't kill anyone that I would be surprised to see dying in another action movie.
Fair enough. Okay, well, I'll just have the last comment, which is that hopefully at some future point we will have a Victor Toombs movie. Should it be about the adventures of Toombs, the bounty hunter? I can dream and hope. Because remember, the movie never tells us if he's dead. We just assume that he's died. But he could have lived. So.
That's a point.
And just to be honest, Toombs is an awesome bounty hunter. So, he's not very good, but he's an interesting character.
I mean, with the exception of Dame Vivaco, I'm not actually sure any character in Chronicles of Riddick is actually good at their job.
No, that's true. Anywho, all right, so we got to grade it. So, Kevy, what grade will you give it?
You know, I am going to give it a B-. I enjoy it a lot, but it has some deep, deep problems. So, there's that.
David?
I'm going to give it a C. Yeah, I mean, there's some things that work for me, but too many things that just don't. So, yeah.
Well, I'm going to give it an A-. because I love this film. I think it's great. And that I'm just going to leave it there. Sorry. So, and since I'm the host of the show, A-minus wins. So, hating on my movie. How dare you? Alrighty, now we can finally go to the film that we're all going to hate on, which is the legitimate horrible film, which is Riddick, which just came out. It's currently made about $78 million worldwide, at least currently by the recording of this podcast, so $75, $76 million. So at this point, we can expect more Riddick movies because it's made money, so they're going to make more. And unfortunately, that's not necessarily a good thing. So why don't we start with general reactions? Keffi, general reaction?
So my main feeling when I got done watching this movie was just sad resignation. Okay, first of all, despite giving Chronicles a B-, my biggest disappointment for the first half of the movie was that apparently it was not going to be a Necromonger movie, which I could have guessed since people were saying, oh, it's more like Pitch Black, and they only paid like $40 million to make it instead of $100 or $120. But I actually liked where they were going with the Necromongers, and leaving them out of this movie gives us this really weird situation where, according to Chronicles of Riddick, there's this force of evil space zombies that are flying around the universe or galaxy, taking over entire star systems and killing or enslaving everyone there. And apparently nobody cares except for Judi Dench. Like, literally, Judi Dench is the only person in the entire galaxy who gives a flying crap that everyone is dying in the entire galaxy. Once I got over that disappointment while watching it, I enjoyed the first part, which is basically just Riddick wandering around this very beautiful landscape and killing monsters. I knew fairly early on that this was a very odd, that the pacing of the movie was going to be thrown off by it by quite a bit, because there's really no plot for the first half of the movie. It's just Riddick wandering around, literally headbutting monsters. But I was down with that because I was like, you know, this is kind of stupid, but apparently that's where they wanted to go with this one. And so far I enjoy it. Then, unfortunately, other characters show up, and the movie goes from being kind of it's not that great, to being a complete crap fest.
I'm sorry, I got to correct you. You mean other actors show up to be on the screen?
Yeah.
Because characters actually show up.
Okay, so a dropship leaves some cardboard cutouts on the planet, and we go from there. I was so disappointed. Mostly because, I watched it and I was like, why am I so disappointed with Dahl, who is the only female character who actually tries to be a character occasionally? And I realized that it's because Pitch Black gave me a reasonable expectation that Twohy had some idea that women are people, and that you might want to write them as people. But then Riddick just, oh God, it's so bad. I'm going to rant, I'll be as brief as I can, but there are only two women in the entire movie. Mm-hmm. One of them is also the only woman of color in the movie, who exists for about 3 minutes so that we can establish that the first mercenary in charge of the first mercenary ship, and I don't remember his name.
Santana
is a bad, bad, evil, bad man. And also that the Christian boy is a complete wimp and completely useless in every way, shape, or form. And then she dies to give Riddick some potential pathos, although he doesn't really seem to have any. He just kind of watches her die. So I guess that's also to show us that Riddick isn't quite a very good person either. And then you have Dahl, who basically exists to be sexually harassed through the entire movie.
Yep.
And I almost liked her. Like, they gave me a moment where I thought, like, maybe this was going to turn around, which was when she's like, yeah, I don't fuck men. And I was like, well, this could go down a better road. But it didn't.
Immediately devolves into, I'm going to sexually harass and then try to rape somebody. Yeah.
I was very disappointed when I got done because I expected a lot better. And then this doesn't even get into my other rant, which is the plot, which basically consists of them condensing the plot of Pitch Black into the last half of the movie, and then doing a play-by-play remake of it, but without any of the characters that made the first movie good. So
yeah, well, I'll talk about that in my rant then.
Okay. Yeah. I'm done, but I was very disappointed.
All right, David, general reactions.
Yeah, I'd second just about all of that. I had fun for the first bit where it's just Riddick. Though, and I hadn't rewatched Chronicles yet when I saw this, so the Necromongers were just in memory to me, and so the I wasn't feeling that acute disappointment. I was just trying to remember, who were these guys when they showed
Rocco
up briefly?
Shows up.
Yeah, I was like, why are you here? And then when I rewatched Chronicles of Riddick, and so in other words, everything that this movie was doing is now invalidated, who cares? We're on to this one. Everything about Dahl and what kind of a tin ear doesn't realize that giving the character that name, when we hear her name, we're not going to picture D-A-H-L. We're going to hear D-O-L-L and make that even worse.
Yeah.
And I remember I think it was on Dinner for Fiends, the summed up everything that was wrong about Aliens versus Predator Requiem with the sentence, "The aliens chase the teenagers through the high school." Well, for me, there's an almost equivalent moment in Riddick, which is Riddick steals the female mercenary's makeup kit. And then it just devolves into a dumbed down pitch black, and it was boring. It wasn't even bad in a good way. Whatever my issues are with Chronicles, it is still entertaining, right? I was never bored by that. Whereas in the last two thirds of Riddick, I kept looking at my watch.
Yeah, that's pretty much what I would say is this is possibly, I didn't know it was possible to take a character like Riddick and make him so boring, but like, I didn't like almost any part of this film. I thought almost all of it was just pretty much terrible. There aren't many redeeming qualities of the film, and one of the worst parts is the fact that the plot does not know what kind of movie this is. When they wrote this movie, they thought that, I don't know what they were thinking they were writing, because the last, third-ish is basically just pitch black. The problem with that is, in pitch black, we get lots of hints that there's some sort of scary thing happening before the scary thing happens, but in this film, in Riddick, they never really give us enough information for us to figure out why the big water storm is scary. Like, what it turns out, it's those weird scorpion creatures. If the water will make it so they can go out more, but there's no indication that those are an infestation. Whereas in Pitch Black, right, we see, we learn that those creatures live underneath the ground where those little, like, tubular things are where they're going to come out of. So when we see those tubular things everywhere, we go, holy fuck, they are everywhere, right? There are probably millions of these things living around. In this movie, it's like he has a battle with like five of them. Right, and saves his puppy, which is the only redeeming quality of the film, as it should have just been Riddick as a boy and his dog. That should have just been the whole movie. No other humans, just him and the dog.
The only two parts of the movie that were at all worth having been filmed were the scene where he saves his puppy and like slides under the biggest monster and disembowels it, because that was so over-the-top ridiculous that I was like, well, at least it was entertaining. As he saves his puppy. And then also, unfortunately, by that point in the movie, I'd stopped caring about pretty much everything, including my own life. I could have died and would have I didn't care. I was so nihilistic and whatever. If they had framed it better, they could have done something with Riddick climbing a mountain in a thunderstorm, clubbing monsters with a femur. Like, that was kind of awesome, but unfortunately, they ruined it with everything that went before and after it.
Yeah, that's this whole thing is terrible.
And Riddick is really a dull character now, right? I have that issue more or less with the second film too. But there's just you know, we've gone from psychotic anti-hero who is also a real, you know, quite a badass, but all right, there's this kind of redemption to, wow, look how invincible he is, to now God finds him invincible. Right? So every line is just, well, you know, I'm going to kill you this way now. And then he does it and everyone's, wow, cool. You are so amazing. Giving us the most, you know, I thought we'd gotten past lesbian conversions with Goldfinger, but apparently not.
No, we're still dealing with that. Yeah. There's a lot of problems with this movie, and there aren't many redeeming things. I've already said that, but I guess I'll just get out of the way the things that I thought that were redeeming, and then we can just bash on this film some more. So one thing that I thought was redeeming was the fact that at least half of the cast, and particularly most of the cast who have at least, you know, three or four lines of dialogue, are people of color or women. Although we've talked about Doll already as being not a particularly good character, but that's secondary. But most of the characters are people of color, which I really appreciated, because that almost never happens in science fiction movies where even your main character is a person of color. So that was nice. I liked that. Visually, for the fact they spent $38 million on this, it's bloody gorgeous. It looks nice. The monsters are, I mean, they're a little ridiculous, but whatever. So were, I guess, the ones from Pitch Black. But are really well done. I also really did like the dog, except for the part where I became very much aware that the dog was going to have to die as a catalyst for Riddick to act a certain way, which I didn't see as necessary at all. So... but I guess the dog is supposed to humanize him. I don't really understand why the dog's there, but
pop it into the fridge too.
Yeah, it's another, but like it, I just felt like even the way the dog acts was kind of like, this is a wild dog creature. It's not a real dog. It's some sort of like local canine-ish species, right? So for me, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense why the dog would act that way. Because it's still a wild animal. It's not like you can just get a wolf and be like, yeah, I'm going to raise a wolf pup. And it's going to be totally like just like everyone else's dog. No, that's going to bite him. It's going to be violent. It's going to be mean. It's not going to be goofy, right? That's basically what this dog is. It's goofy. Running around. And that didn't make a whole lot of sense. Although I did really like the dog. And I still think the movie should have just been Riddick and his dog running around, terrorizing the landscape. But like, I just felt like... There's also a lot in, I don't know, like, I like the people of color, I like the visuals, I like the dog. That's pretty much the end of stuff that I thought was good. I did appreciate that they tried to let us know how he ended up here, and so that it connected to the previous film, even though I thought the way they did it was horrible.
That didn't make any sense.
It didn't make any sense, but at least I appreciated they tried.
I'm sitting there, I'm like... While I'm watching it, I'm like, so did Riddick go, like, did they conquer any planets while Riddick was in charge for 5 years? Or did he just make them hang out on Helion Prime? And then if he was, like, would it really take 5 years for Vako to, like, get around to figuring out a way to get rid of him? Like, I don't know. I just had a lot of problem with it being 5 years. Like, maybe if it was a week later or something. But I was just like, okay, regardless of whether or not Vako would have taken care of it, his wife would have kicked his ass if he let Riddick stay in charge for 5 years. Like, she would have killed Riddick herself.
She would have poisoned him.
Yeah, she should have. That would have been a better movie.
Oh, first moment is Riddick dies and her husband becomes Lord Marshall. It wouldn't be called Riddick. It would be called Lord Marshall.
It would be called Dan Vako is a Badass, and it would probably be a better movie than what we got.
Which is why we need that movie, too. We should have, you know, we should have a movie called Tombs and a movie called Lord Marshall or Vako. It's just called Vako.
Well, we do have to find out exactly, yeah, what are the Necromongers doing now? They just decided to hang? I mean, yeah.
No, they must be conquering more planets.
Well, and then, okay, wait. And then there's also the problem where, you know, you keep what you kill, right? So why would Vako send someone else to kill Riddick? Because now isn't the ugly dude the guy in charge?
Yeah, exactly. Oh, yeah.
I mean, unless Vako's going to wait for him to climb off and be like, okay, well, this guy's easier to kill because he doesn't expect it, which is way too smart for Vako. So
I don't know. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense. I also, like, I don't know. they try to make the connection, but you're right, it doesn't make any sense. And they do it really ham-fistedly. Like, the way in which the film is structured shouldn't have been structured that way. I think they should have just started with, like, him being, you know, pissed off because Vako's like, hey, dude, we got to go, like capture some planets. And he's like, dude, I just want to get drunk and get the fuck out of here. And that would be the beginning, right? And then he's like, but I'll take you to Furia. And then he does it, really. I don't know. Like, there's the whole deception, which doesn't make any sense. Like, so they deceive him. But, like, what's the purpose of that? I mean, other than just to suggest that Vako is a scheming, you know, backstabbing bastard, but, like, that doesn't add anything that's useful. Like, they could have just taken him to Furia. Furia is supposed to be wasteland, right? So just drop him on Furia and be like, have a good time. Fuck off.
Yeah, I'm not sure what he's planning on doing on Furia. Like, especially since, like, in this movie, apparently the way that he figures out he's not on Furia is by sniffing the dirt, and he's like, oh, this isn't Furia, because I know what the dirt smells like there, apparently.
That's his Furian powers. He can smell dirt really well. It's a dirt sniffer. But, like, but why didn't they just leave him on Furia? Like, I don't understand. There's no real, like, Furia is a wasteland, so that planet could easily have just been Furia. It doesn't make any sense for Vako to deceive him, because basically he said, look, you take me to Furia, you can have the Necromongers, and we're done. So there's no reason for the deception.
Except that the Necromongers are jerks, and that's what they do.
Well, that's stupid. Like, Vako is, whatever. It just seems, I don't know, it just...
Yeah, I don't know. Like, I also don't know, like, why they would care if he got to Furia. Like, he's already done, like, the worst thing he can pretty much do to them, which is kill their leader and take his job. Like, I don't, like, what is he going to do if he gets his Furian powers? Kill the Lord Marshal? Like,
he's already the Lord Marshal.
He already did that.
And apparently, as far as any kind of redemption is concerned, his concerns about this unstoppable army of zombies wiping out the galaxy, he's cool with it as long as they drop him off at Furia.
Yeah, which is another thing. It's, you know, that all that goes out the window, and that's one of my problems with the way that the character is structured here. Is in the other films, you know, I know you guys disagree that there isn't an arc in the Chronicles, but it seemed to me that the other films were, you know, he starts being this badass killer, and then he sort of starts changing a leaf. He's still a badass killer, but he's a nice badass killer, sort of. And here it's like we've gone backwards, and I think that has a lot to do with the way that the film wants us to think it is basically just pitch black again, and which is something that just doesn't work. And that's one of the things that doesn't work for me, is the fact that nothing that Riddick does in this film, except for getting the puppy, that's the only thing that was surprising for me. That everything else is not surprising. So when he threatens to kill everybody, that's not a shock to us. It was a shock in Pitch Black, because that was not something we expected, right? Like, because weren't introduced to the characters. In Chronicles of Riddick, when he had the amazing choreography and he's just killing all these people, right? That was very cool to watch, because it wasn't something we'd seen yet. In this, they're trying to do all this stuff with Riddick to make him seem like he's a badass killer, but the problem is we already know. So all of this is sort of very boring, and so even when he has his fights, they're not interesting fights, right? And it also presents the problem that halfway through the film, when the other characters start showing up, they suddenly become the central characters, and Riddick goes backwards. He becomes the side character, which doesn't make sense, because we've just been following Riddick this whole time, and suddenly we're not supposed to care what Riddick is doing. Because if they stayed in his character, of course, we would know that he planted all of the traps and all those kinds of things. It's a POV shift that shouldn't exist. It's whatever they were thinking when they created did the writing. Like, does Twohy do the writing? Is he the writer?
Yeah,
he should be fired.
Twohy has, if you look at him on IMDb, he has an interesting track record, because apparently he wrote The Fugitive and Waterworld. So the fact that his Riddick movies are written completely schizophrenically and all over the board
But he did G.I. Jane, too.
You know what? I'm just going to say he can write good and can write bad. And we have seen that in this series.
But that's what's really weird, is he can write really good and then he can write really bad. Wow.
I mean, I'm not actually surprised there's a point of view shift in this movie, because it's three completely separate types of movie in one. Because it starts off as being this, like, sword and sorcery, you know, you said boy and his dog. And then in the middle, like, it turns into this weird sort of almost slapstick comedy routine, except people are getting chomped in half by giant traps. But, like, all of the dialogue in that entire middle part is meant to be somewhat funny. And we're supposed to be laughing at, you know, the dude with the head in the box and all that stuff. And then the ending, it tries to turn into another, you know, monster science fiction movie like Pitch Black and Alien and stuff, and really doesn't get there. So it's just, oh my gosh.
Why do they keep giving him money? I'm like looking, I'm sorry, like I totally got really weird. Like I was looking through all of the box office numbers for his movies, and he had a bomb in the film Imposter. It was a $30 million budget. It made $8 million worldwide. Terminal Velocity had a $50 million budget. It only made $16 million. Imposter had a $30 million. Oh, I already did that one. Sorry. I was just going to double up. And then he made a film called Below, which he only made $605,000, which tells me that was probably not the budget.
That is actually a really good ghost story, that one. It's a haunted submarine, and it works really well.
There's no way they made it for $600,000, though. Anywhere in that vicinity. That must cost millions. At least a couple.
A few, yeah. No, that must be a mistake. But that is actually that was a quite a good film.
I don't understand how he's. It's not fair. But I see you put a hand up, David. So go ahead.
Oh yeah, I was going to sort of the second on the choreography. Like the fighting is just not interesting, right? The killing of the monsters is boring because it we saw it before in Pitch Black, and even the monsters look kind of like the ones from Pitch Black. And when we're supposed to get one of these badass moments when he's telling Santana, "Okay, I'm going to kill you with this blade, and it's going to take 5 seconds and so forth," and then he does it, and I'm sitting there thinking, "Yeah, I know. I saw Drew Barrymore do that in Charlie's Angels, so." That's the echo I'm getting here, which is probably not what you wanted me to get.
Yeah, or it doesn't quite that whole scene, that particular scene's terrible, by the way. They've captured him and he's sitting in the chair and they're like, "We're gonna cut your head off," and he's like, "I'm gonna kill you in 5 seconds," and everyone's like, "Okay," like, "Whatevs," and then they're like, "Oh, he killed him in 5 seconds," right? They're all like shocked, but the whole scene takes forever because the dialogue, like, they say 5 words and then they just stop for like a minute and a half. Or what feels like a minute and a half. It's probably like 10 seconds. But it's just these long stretches of silence. But nobody's doing anything interesting. And it became a parallel that I noticed because there's this really hilarious scene that's really, really well done in Chronicles of Riddick when he's in the prison. And he's like goes up to the guards and he's like, you know, she doesn't like to be touched. And they're like, "Go away, you know, you need to leave." And he's like, you know, if you don't like leave me alone, I'm going to kill you. And with my teacup, and the one guy goes up to him and he says, you know, "What happens in this little world of yours where we don't listen to you?" Right. And then he kills him with the teacup, and then he takes out the little like pointy thing and he puts it on the rock, right? As though this is a game. And the scene is well played out, it's very well paced. And it adds that kind of humor, that kind of morbid humor in it. This has no morbid humor. He just says, "I'm gonna kill you in the first 5 seconds." And then he does it. And it's not even like he cuts his head in half. And it falls into the box, which is like, "Whoa, what'd you do?" But
which, you know, for other things that reminds you of, that particular death reminded me of the horrifying and terrible ending of Underworld. That first, I think it's called Underworld. It was like one of those horribly bad vampires versus werewolves movies.
Did it have Kate Beckinsale in it?
I think
she's
so.
In a latex suit?
Yeah, I watched it like 10 years ago, but it was
that
just
that movie's great.
That movie was so bad, especially right at the ending. They're like, "We're going to have a massive battle scene." "Oh, nope, because his head's been chopped in half already. You just didn't notice." It's like, did your budget run out? Anyway, I actually think that part of what made that scene that you were talking about in Riddick so bad is that had it been written reasonably competently, it did something accidentally that it could have done intentionally that would have been actually useful in the third movie of this series. Because we have Riddick, and he's, you know, he was put in Butcher Bay not for being a nice guy, right? So you have this murderer. We've only seen him kill people who, quote unquote, deserve it or are trying to kill him, one or the other. And through his arc, I felt like by the end of this movie, we were sort of forgetting that he is not just a badass, but he's also kind of a terrible person. And he's basically a sociopath. And so in that last scene, some of his dialogue sort of shocked me in that it reminded me. It's like, you know, by the way, this dude that you've been watching for three movies that you really like is actually not a nice person. And he actually is a cold-blooded killer. But unfortunately, it was done so incompetently that it didn't work because the rest of the scene was boring. But had they done it well, it could have been really interesting.
Okay, yeah, no, I totally agree. And just as my last thing to say before, and then David, you can get one more comment in, and then we'll probably grade this, is the one other thing that does not work is the narrative with Boss Johns. And in the Riddick, they tried to follow up on the character in Pitch Black named Johns, and they basically bring his father in, and basically he wants to know what happens to his son, and he has to reveal to the father that the son was a junkie and all this shit and whatever, blah, blah, blah. But in any case, right, they have this whole narrative, and then they get to the end, and they let Riddick into the ship, and they let him go. Like, they just let him fly away, and it never made any sense to me, because it's not like he did anything particularly worthy for Boss Johns to deserve being let to live. Nothing happens that makes that make sense to me. It just sort of happens. And he's like, well, I don't want to know where you're going. You're just going to go. And it's like, well, no. This guy's wanted. He's a murderer. And you came after him to capture him. And you were had no problem with letting Santana cut his head off. So shoot him out of the fucking sky.
I have a theory on that one.
Okay.
Basically, during his like third or fourth bout of self-surgery in the movie, when he cauterizes his weeping chest wound with a lump of rock, he activated his Mary Sue powers. And as a result, was saved. Because by the end of the movie, he has become literally the largest Mary Sue I've ever seen in any movie.
Oh, and, yeah.
And I use that as the like character for whom nothing can go wrong, not the... Well, actually, you know what? Frankly, he could be a self-insert. We don't know that much about Twohee, but... that ending horrified me as well, because there's nothing that makes it work. And the only reason that him getting saved worked at the end of Pitch Black was that he had shown Fry that he was capable of coming... Basically, that he was capable of helping someone survive somehow, maybe. But, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't work.
Well, and I was going to say basically the same thing you just did, Sean. The attempt to do the kind of reverse arc of the anti-Johns with the redemption of Father Johns was fairly laughable for the most part. The characters weren't behaving in any consistent fashion. It was okay. Now you're ticked, and now you're not. And yeah, at the end, all of a sudden they're behaving like he just rescued them. I was like, wait a minute, you rescued him.
Yeah.
Now why are you so grateful? And yeah, none of it made any sense.
None of it made. There's all kinds of stuff that doesn't make any sense, but yeah. But in any case, we got to stop. So, Keffi, what would you grade this?
I am going to give it a D.
A D? That's generous.
The reason it's not an F is just how pretty the beginning was, and the scene where he kills the monster while sliding under it with a puppy in his arms, because that was really awesome. Just unfortunately, the rest of the movie sucks.
I love that. I love the dog. Want a pet dog. All right, David.
Yeah, I'm going to give it a D also for that opening had some fun stuff with it before it just went into terminal meh.
Terminal meh. I like it. Yeah. Oh. I don't know. I hate this movie so much. I really do. I was trying to think of what I gave it in my review, my like massive like 4,000 word rant review. I gave it a D+. Really? Really? The more I think about this, well, I guess I'm giving it a D+. So I don't know why I hate this film.
Well, our D's, Keffi and my D's wind up canceling out the plus, so it's got a D overall.
It's pretty terrible.
If that makes you feel better.
No, it doesn't. Doesn't.
I wanted to like this so bad. I mean, I went into it expecting to love it, and I went into it thinking that I would like it the way I liked Chronicles of Riddick, which is semi-ironically, but I couldn't even muster that for it.
No, it's not a likable film. Like, I think by the time the second team of Merc people show up, I was just like, okay, at this point, this is really boring now. Like, how much more character issues can we put in here? You know, basically, I would describe this film as Riddick solves family problems. And you, if you know who Riddick is, you know why that's not good.
No, but that was Chronicles.
Chronicles, he didn't solve family problems in Chronicles.
Yeah, he did. He solved the adopted little sister problem by letting her die.
Well, but I would describe that film as Riddick reluctantly saves the world and then gets kind of pissy because he has to now have power.
I describe that one as Conan in space.
Or that works, too.
Here it's Riddick gives a grieving father closure.
But only like half-ass closure, because he still kills Johns.
No, he doesn't.
He killed Johns. The other Johns, he killed him.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, which Johns are you talking
about?
I'm
sorry. Yeah. Boss Johns is the father. Other yeah. Johns is just...
Yeah. Father Johns comes to terms with who his son was.
Yeah, only half-assly.
Like, oh, my God. Yeah, it's so bad. He doesn't even make him feel better. He's like, oh, yeah, I did kill your son, but if it makes you feel any better, he was a terrible human being.
No, actually, he says he didn't kill his son, right? He just leaves him to get eaten by the monsters, right? So
technically, he didn't kill him.
Yeah, so he does tell Johns, no, I didn't kill your son, and he sucked as a person.
I think
which
what
apparently
he's trying
makes Johns feel better in the long run. Yeah. So
I think what he's trying to say is Johns killed himself by basically being that horrible person, because Johns basically like. He's just trying to backstab Riddick the whole time, and the only reason they get in that fight is because Johns basically comes after Riddick. And
the only thing that I can imagine could possibly be going through Boss Johns' head is, well, my son was a drug addict? Well, fuck him.
Who cares? Alrighty, well, on that front, we gotta stop. So thank you, Keffi and David, for coming on and talking about these three films.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we will see everybody for whatever the next Shoot the Wisp segment will be. It's either Babylon 5 or Gravity. Or maybe okay. Not Gravity. Maybe it's Babylon 5. I don't know. But in any case, we'll see everybody next time. So bye!
Bye.
Bye.
If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google Plus.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
Just another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
End of line.